And I do hope you will have questions, because otherwise I will just keep talking and talking and talking. You will fall asleep one by one. So you have to have questions. You probably are wondering what that is. This is a tradition in Berkeley in California, outside San Francisco. Every Halloween, there is this road. It's like, I don't know, a kilometer or something like that long. And every house has some special theme for around Halloween. So some have giant spiders, some have witches and something like that. But these guys, they have these cut out from board. So it looks like someone is coming up through from the earth, sort of. Anyway, you will see more pictures during, not specifically from that, but from other places too. So this is the course in UOLF. JW, I said star because there actually is a family. And then some OpenID Connect. And we are two who are going to help you sort of get through this course. And it's me, Roland Hedberg, and then it's Yannis. And he's not here yet. He will come around noon. And just a few things about me. I've been around for some time. So I started in this line of business, you could say, in 87. This is quite some time ago. So if everyone remembers X500, the X400, I sort of started in doing that. I went over to do LDAP. Actually, I worked with the IETF, Internet Engineering Task Force, for standardizing LDAP. For a couple of years, I was actually chair of the working group, the LDAP working group. So I've done a lot with directories, and then sort of after around 2002, 2003 or something like that, I drifted over to doing identity management sort of as a whole. So I actually implemented SAML. My favorite language is Python. I do everything in Python. So I have a SAML implementation called PySAML2, and it's been, last time I checked, it's been downloading over 1 million times from the PyPy site. About 5 or 6 years ago, I got involved in OpenID Connect, and I've been part of that standardization work and followed that since then. I also implemented UOAuth and OpenID Connect, of course, again in Python. And it's progressing rather nicely. And the thing the reason I was brought into OpenID Connect was actually to produce tools for implementers to verify their implementation. So if you were to write an OpenID Connect implementation and you wanted to check that it was correct, you would use these tools I have provided. And we'll talk more about that later today. We'll get back to looking at what they actually do. Basically, we divided this course is 2 days. So the first day is theory. So that's, I will bombard you with information. And hopefully you will get it through and get some information from out of it. After that, the next day, it's hands-on. So you are expected to do all the work on day two. Me and Yannis will just be here to help you. There are some prepared things you can do. So basically, we have an Apache module you can play with. There is some Java library, and of course, there is the Python library. And there are some exercises that we'd like you to go through. Building an RP, which is probably the most common things for people to do. But then if you also want to look at an OP, you're absolutely free to do that too. So it's your choice what you want to do, but we have prepared some things. And as you see here, I haven't divided the day into, I haven't sort of specified when we will have the break before in lunch and the break after. So we'll just take it when it sort of fits into where we are. Oh, by the way, do you know each other? No. So maybe you should start by going around and sort of please introduce yourself. Should we do a mic? Are you going to start? Well, Missy, you're already.
I'm Despo. I'm from Cyprus. I work at University of Cyprus. I work in the. We have an identity manager, and I'm responsible for it. And also about the Microsoft infrastructure, it doesn't fit in this course.
Okay, go.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Antonis Chirkalis. I'm an officer at CYNET in Cyprus, the NRN. I'm here to see how we can use the open authentication in some projects that we would like to develop. Okay, that's it.
Excellent.
Hi, hello everyone. I am from Poznań, from Poznań Supercomputing and Networking Center. And I am a member of a team responsible for maintaining chance services for developers, such as Jira and so on. And I think it's all.
Hello, I'm also from Poznań Supercomputing and Networking Center. My name is Maciej Wabenski, and I'm a developer. And right now I'm taking part in SA2T1, which is about auditing software. I'm also involved in School for Developers event organization.
Hello, my name is Tomasz Kozinski. I work for NIIF here at KIFU. My tasks are mainly storage related, but I'm looking forward to integrate our services in a way that we could use these techniques.
Hello, I'm Krzysztof Bojnok, and I'm one of the operators of the Hungarian Research Federation, which is SAML-based.
Hello, my name is Janos Mohaci. I am responsible for the development at our NRN. So I am head of the development.
Hi all, I'm Jovan Volet from Belgrade University Computer Center. Actually, I work there as software architect, but I work on a lot of projects healthcare related. We have close collaboration with AMRES, actually, that is Serbian. And then I work on Giant, I work on SDN networks. I also support some tools for AMDV VPN service, so I'm really interested in security and identity management.
Hi, my name is Dubrav Kovončina from Zagreb University Computing Center. I am one of the administrators of Croatian Academic and Research Federation, which is primarily based on SAML protocol, and we are looking to extend our functionality to some other protocol.
Okay, I'm actually working on Giant task related to Stunturn, and I'm very interested in the OAuth relationship with these protocols, and also working some WebRTC related tasks in Giant.
Hi, my name is Tamás, and I'm one of the federation operators of EDYD in Hungary, the Hungarian Federation.
Hi, my name is Gyula Szabó, and we are a colleague. So I working in the Hungarian Federation operator in role of development.
Hello, my name is Szilárd Varga. I work in a cafe in Debrecen. I develop multimedia web applications as usual.
Hello, I am Sándor Pető. I work since a year here in Kifu. I am a member of the multimedia team.
Hi, my name is Kuk János. János Kuk, sorry. I work in Debrecen and I am a software developer.
Interesting. So we have a complete mix of people, all the way from software architects, system architects, over to developers. That's going to be interesting. So there was some mentioning about sort of people using SAML, and I'm actually myself. I work with the Swedish NREN. An identity federation, so SWAMID. I'm part of the operations team there, so I'm also sort of doing SAML. I'm not going to specifically talk about the differences and similarities between SAML and OpenID Connect. I could do that if you want to, but I will concentrate on OAuth and OpenID Connect, and you'll probably, well, I may mention, but otherwise you just have to figure out sort of what the differences are. And I think you'll do that. Start with OAuth, which is sort of the building block of everything here. It's described in two RFCs. So it's RFC 6749 and 6750. And it's described as being no authorization. Notice that, no authorization. It's not about authentication, it's about authorization. So giving someone access to some resource. That is what OAuth is built for. Now, OAuth is a framework. So it's sort of a mesh, you could say. So it gives you pointers to how things should be done, but it leaves a lot for you to choose if you want to do things one way or the other. And you will notice that during this talk. So the entities that are involved is, of course, there is a user, which in most cases is the person sitting at sort of his computer, and there is a web client in there. And there is a service that this person wants to use. And this person wants to give that service. And in this case, the service is represented as the client, access to some resource, and wants to use an authorization server to do that. So those are the participants in this dance. There are different ways you can do this, and it depends actually on this guy, sort of. Is this a person sitting at a web client on a computer? In that case, you may want to use authorization code grant. If the person is running a program inside a web browser, it's not on the machine, the program isn't running on the machine, it's running inside the web browser, then you may want to use implicit grant. If there is no person, or actually there is a person, but the person has such a trust into the program that the person has given the program its username and password, such that the program is actually working on behalf of the user, then you can use this. And lastly, if there is just a client, there is no user, the client is working on its own. So this is a server-server thing. So you may have a service that want to access information from another service without involving any user. So those are the flows that OAuth defines all four of them. So you can see that it actually it spans a very large width of use cases, which of course means that if there is someone who has implemented OAuth for doing authorization code grant and someone else implemented for doing client credentials, they can't talk to each other because they are doing things so differently. So that's one of the problems with OAuth. No, these are all the possibilities. So the question were if this is the whole set of them or if it's just sort of possible. No, this is the set that is defined in the RFC. They actually added another one later. So there is a fifth. I don't know if, yeah, we'll see about that. So we just take the most common. When you talk about using OAuth, it's mostly sort of in the context of Google wants to you to log in, or rather, sort of you want to use a service and the service asks you, you have to log in. Do you want to use Facebook, Google, or whatever, sort of? And in that case, you use CodeFlow. Unfortunately, Google do it, well, not unfortunately for Google's case, but Google does it correctly because they're using OpenID Connect, which is actually an authentication system as well as an authorization system. Facebook, on the other hand, they are using OAuth, which is an authorization, but they have added their own stuff to make it sort of also do authentication. So they're not really, well, they sort of follow the standard, but not really. But it's typical Facebook, so. No one was expecting anything else. So this whole thing starts then with an authorization request. So normally this user uses the web browsers, goes to a site and wants to do something, and the site says you have to authenticate to do this, or you have to, which is, yeah, well, normally, though it's in authorization, which is needed. So what happens then is that the client is sending a request to the authorization server. And there is a couple of things in that request. One is a client ID, and that is of course because the authorization server needs to know who is asking. How does the client know it client's ID? Undefined in OAuth. It just happens. It has happened sometime before in some way, undefined by OAuth.
Is there any best practice?
If you want to use Google again as an example, Google will crop up all of the time as an example here. If you want to use Google, you have to go to a website, register as a developer, and then on the web page, enter all the necessary information that defines your client, and then you will get the client ID and the client secret from them. So it's completely out of band.
By a client ID, you mean actually an application ID, something like application ID?
Well, it is the software that is asking the question. You also have to provide the redirect URI, and the reason for that is it's a URL. This is an asynchronous event. So you ask the question, and sometimes later, you get a reply. And where do you get the reply to? Well, you get it to the redirect URI. So in your question, you say, I want the reply coming back to here. And in most cases, like when, if you want to register to Google, you have to register the redirect URI in advance. That is one thing that Facebook didn't do correctly. So they allowed people to dynamically create redirect URI when they post a question, which led to people using this in ways that Facebook didn't really like, because it opened up some security holes. So you have really have to register those in advance. Response type is to tell the authorization server which of these four flows you want to use. So that is what you put in the response type. Then scope is what do I do, what type of authorization do I want? What do I want to do? The simplest case is that, for instance, I want to read some information, or I want to write some information. So that's scope. Scope is not defined in the standard. There is no list of verbs, you could say, or something like that. So it's your application. Whatever this guy does, that specifies sort of what scopes there is. And then lastly, there is state.
And is scope optional?
Scope is optional. But it's actually. So you could imagine, of course, posing a question saying, I want access. But then sort of access to what? You don't say. But it's completely possible to do that. Because it may be that this resource server only does one thing. Then it's sort of, why ask for something? Because it only can do one thing. So, and when you construct one of these questions, you have a problem, will have a problem reading this because it's so low. It's okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a URL, so you do a GET, and there is an endpoint, and how you know the endpoint is also outside the specification of OAuth. In Google's case, again, there is a website where they list all the endpoints you can use. Later on we will see how you can do this dynamically. So that's the endpoint authorization, and then you add state. State is supposed to be a value that the client can use when it gets the response back to know which question was this the answer to. Because this may actually have several users here sort of using it at the same time, so it may have several outstanding questions. So it has, in order to know sort of this response I got back, which question was it? Is it connected to? I use the state, so it's a state variable. So it's just some long, random string. Redirect URI, that's where the response came back. Response type, in this case code, and then the client ID. For the application, it's not for the user. There's nothing here that tells you who the user is. Because that's the next part. The authorization server does authentication and consent management and authorization and everything like that. So the client doesn't know who the user is. If you use OAuth, the client doesn't. So all that happens on the authorization server side. And this may take seconds, minutes, hours, whatever, sort of, depending. And then eventually there is a response. And it goes back to this redirect URI. And the response contains two things. It can contain more things, but these are the ones that are specified in the standard. So it's state, so you know the question sort of connected to the response. And it's code. In this case, code is a access code, you can say. So that's what you get back that in some way represents the authorization you asked for. So it's a key, you can say. So the next thing is that you use that. You use that key and you send it to the authorization server again, but to another endpoint, the access token endpoint. And again, in this, you send the client ID, you send the code. Grant type is to tell the authorization server what kind of access code am I giving you. Because they imagined at this point in time that there would be several of these. And actually, one grant type is the SAML assertion. So there is a specification for how to, if you can imagine, you have the OAuth authorization server here, but the thing that is doing the authentication and everything like that is a SAML IDP back here. You can get the SAML assertion, so this actually works as an SP. So this gets an assertion, this can actually use the assertion as the code. Could also create sort of another, a new one, sort of based on that, but it can actually use specifically the SAML assertion. There is an RFC that describes how to do that. The other types of grant type, and we will see some of them later. And then redirect URI again, and these, some of these things you see pop up in these questions and these requests and responses are there because they want to mitigate some security problem. This is just telling this that this is where I got back your response. If you want to sort of coordinate that to where you sent the code to, this should sort of actually have a relationship. At this point, also, the client have to authenticate itself with the authorization server. And there are several ways of doing that. Basic HTTP authentication is one, which is that the client uses a username and password. And that is, of course, the client ID and the client secret. This is a very... Well, it is allowed, but it's not recommended. In return, you get an access token. So now you switch the code you got back into an access token. And you get some information about that. You get an access token, which is again is a opaque string, is what the standard says. So it's not something that the client should be able to interpret. That turned out not to be an excellent choice. We'll see more about that. You also get some information about when it expires. So to note at this point in time that the code can only be used once. So if you've used it once to get sort of to swap it for an access token, it should be invalid then. Sort of the next time someone tries to use it, it should be invalid.
Is it the token that gets invalidated, or is it the?
So actually, what the standard says is that if the authorization server gets two requests for getting access token and they present the same code,
yes.
What should happen is that the authorization server should refuse the second.
I see. So the code is an alt or a
It's a one-time password, you could say. But it shouldn't just refuse to do sort of the second request, but it also should invalidate the access token. Because at that point in time, you don't know whether someone got the code, some hacker got the code before the client got it and used it before the client, or if it's the other way around. So to sort of do the safe thing, you just invalidate the access token and sort of start all over, sort of from the beginning. Scope, if you ask for a scope, you should get back sort of a notion about what you actually got, because you may have asked for read and write, but what you actually got was only read. And this is where the authorization server can tell you what you actually got, for what kind of authorization you got. And then it's what kind of token. We'll see that there are several different types. And then again, state. So state follows you around here. And again, it's sort of so such that you can keep all these things together. You post an authorization request with state as a parameter. You got back state in the response. You post an access token request which didn't contain the state, but you got back state in the response. So you can, in the client, you can actually sort of keep these together.
Roland, is there any best practice about scope selection? I see that Google has some URI scopes and other procedures in different ways. So is there any?
So best practice regarding scope. As I said, there is no standard for scope values. So it's up to the applications, which means that you should use URIs or URLs, because that's the only way to make them globally unique. Otherwise, if you use read, I use read, it may not be the same thing. So it may be very confusing for the users, or the clients for that matter. So I think the common consent is that you should use URLs. So the access token you get back now is a string again, and it represents some kind of authorization that the client then can use against the resource server. And it's usually opaque. The access token is what's called the bearer token, which means that whoever has the access token can use it. It's like if you have the key that is sort of in the door there. If I have it, I can use it. If Misi has it, he can use it. So that's a bearer token. It's not connected either to Misi or me. There's nothing sort of. The lock in that door doesn't know it's me using it or anyone else, because it's the key that gives me the authorization. This is the same thing, which in some cases is okay, in some cases isn't. In some cases you really want to bind this access token to a specific client, mostly, not specifically a user, but specifically a client. But in some cases also the user. But this is where we started. So this was the start, bearer token. Anyone can use it. Anyone who has it can use it, which is good in some cases, because you may want to delegate this. You got the access token, but these other guys or these other clients should really use it, so you can transfer it to that, to the other party. So that's okay in those cases. But there are lots and lots of cases where bearer token is not the thing to use. Now, as you saw, when you got back the response, it expires. So what do you do when it expires? In SAML, you have to authenticate again. There's no way around that. In OAuth, you can use a refresh token. So besides getting an access token, you also get the refresh token. So the access token may be valid for like an hour, but the refresh token has unlimited validity. It can sort of be used forever. But what it only means is that when your access token times out, you have to ask for getting a new one. But then every time you ask, the authorization server can say, nope, you're not allowed to get a new one. Because the user may have decided, or the organization, or whoever may have decided that this access token, you've used it enough. You used it 5 times. Maybe it's you have that kind of limitation. You can use it 5 or 10 times or 15 or whatever. But then so the authorization server can be fully in control on sort of keeping tabs on how often you used it and how long you really are supposed to use it, or if someone wants to say it's not valid anymore for whatever reason. You have a security issue. You want to say every access token is invalid. This is how you would do that. You know, if you talk, if you go give a course like this, you should drink a lot. You may not realize it, but when you're talking, you are actually sort of spitting all the time and you're losing water all the time. I did a course once in Stockholm. It was a whole day, it was on LDAP. And after the day was through, it was like 6-7 hours course. I went to the hotel. I was going to do a second day, sort of next day. And I came up to the reception, sort of, I was checking in, and she asked me, of course, name. And I didn't have a voice. It was absolutely dried up. I couldn't say anything. I had to write it down on a piece of paper. And then I knew I had to be up there the next day, do 6 hours more, and I couldn't talk. But I drank and I drank and I drank during that evening, so actually worked out in the end. Well, that was an experience, I must say. Anyway, refresh token. So you can actually ask for another access token. And again, this client ID, scope. So you can actually change what you're asking for. When I did the authorization, I asked for read, write, update. But the next time, I only want read. So I can actually ask for that. So I can change. At the same time, sort of the authorization server can change what scopes I get every time I ask for a new access token. And then eventually you use this access token to get us some resource. And how you do that is completely outside the specification. It only says that you in some way you present your access token and in some way you get a result. How it happens is outside the scope of the specification. Yeah, so that's sort of one normal way of doing that. So another way you're representing sort of the process that we are going through here is this one. You have a swim lane, as it's called. So you start up there with someone sitting at the browser, going to the page start, the client or the relaying party realizes that the user isn't authorized at this point in time. So it does the redirect over to the authorization endpoint at the authorization server. And in that redirect, it adds information about itself, the client ID, redirect URI state, and so forth.
So is it the resource provider that sets the client ID?
No. It's, well, the authorization server and the resource server, I have them here together because in lots of cases they are very closely linked. So there is some entity there that sort of sets the client ID. But if it's them both together or if it's just the authorization server, I don't know.
So the RP stands for?
Relaying party, that's the client. That's the SP. It's a bit confusing, actually, in some cases. Mostly, you will see that in OAuth, they are talking about client all the time. When you come to OpenID Connect, they're talking about relaying party, RP. And figuring out exactly the difference between client and relaying party is a bit tough, actually. But if for people who are using SAML, sort of, this is the SP. Equivalent, SP equivalent. So you have the authentication, you have the consent management, you have the authorization, everything like that. And then eventually you get the redirect back, go through the browser, and of course, and you end up in the RP again. And the information in there is code and state. And then the RP, and this is sort of, the user isn't aware of this. This is happening in the background regarding the user. The RP then sends a post to the token endpoint and adds information about code, client ID, redirect URI, client secret, and so forth. And eventually you get back a response. And then when you get back access token, then you can use the access token at the resource server. But as I said, the view on the authorization server and the resource server from the point of view of the OAuth working group was that they would be pretty closely connected. Otherwise, how would the RS know anything about what access token could be used for, if it's opaque? If it's just a random string, how the heck would you know what to use it for? In that case, you could imagine sort of they having a common database in the background. So the AS would write something to the database and the RS would read from it. So that's sort of where the whole thing started.
Really?
Yes?
There needs to be a way of validating that token is okay, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. We'll see more about that. So that's a good question. Just to compare with the token, I mean, we were looking at code flow here. And now we have token here. In this case, it starts off the same. You get in this case it's a post. I don't know why that is, but anyway. You get the request for a web page. You get redirected to the authorization endpoint. You do all the authentication, but then when you get redirected back, you get the access token immediately. You don't get the code. You get the access token immediately. So there is no request here for the access token endpoint, for the token endpoint, because you already have the access token. And then you can use that later on. The trick here is that you get it in the fragment. So it's not a query parameter, it's in the fragment. And it's a security issue again. This is typically used for when you're running a application in the web browser. You have a JavaScript application in the web browser. You're not able to keep security, you're not able to keep keys and things like that. So this was designed for doing that. So what you skipped was this, going to the token endpoint and getting the information because you got it immediately. You could also say that you actually save one round trip here, so it's actually faster. Because you just got the response and you get the access token immediately. Here you have to ask for the access token. The third flow type was the resource owner password credentials. In this case, you go immediately to your token endpoint. There's no authorization endpoint invocation here, because there is no user that can do authentication and consent management or anything like that. So you go directly to the token endpoint, and you authenticate as the user. And then you hopefully get an access token and you can use it. So you skipped quite a lot of things here. But we're now going into the sort of arena where the user isn't there. Something is working on behalf of the user. And there are lots of use cases for that. And this is the absolutely simplest then. Client credentials, so there isn't any browser involved or anything. So it's the client on its own, the RP on its own, has its own client ID, client secret. There's no user involved at all. So this is typically service to server, server to server. So this is actually one of the reasons. I was talking to people working in healthcare in Sweden, and they were debating within themselves whether they were going to use SAML or OAuth, OpenID Connect. And they saw this, that they have these different four different flows, and they could sort of see that their use cases where they wanted to move information from one to another, they could actually sort of use all these use cases could be covered by OAuth. In SAML, you can do some of this, but you can't do all of these four. So they saw that as a very sort of big thing, so they could cover all their use cases with one protocol. Therefore, sort of their developers who could ask, they only had to learn OAuth. And then sort of they could use it all over the place. They didn't have to learn SAML and then something else, or even sort of invent something else, because here you didn't have to invent anything. So that's the difference. It's very stripped down. So you see there are actually two different ways of transmitting information. One is you have the URL encoded, which are mostly used in when you do requests, but actually also in some responses. Or you're using a JSON document. So there's no XML. If you love XML, I'm sorry. Or even ASN1 or something like that. So it's just JSON. So pretty simple. So there's the document. So that was OAuth. Any questions about it so far? Everything seems clear. We'll actually dive down into some of these things later. and you will see sort of where there are discussions, where there are holes that has to be filled, where there are ways you can do it differently.
I have one question.
Yes, please.
What is a typical scenario?
We should leave the mic here.
It's a longer question. Okay. What is a typical scenario for this, what you explained until now? Because I can see two types of situations. One is that a typical web application, a user is authenticating and then the user is requesting some page. For example, a personal contact information page. But this is a big action. Then probably when the user saves or updates its profile data, there are a lot of very fine-grained actions somewhere in the backend. Because the database may be complex, the user may have some rights to some specific records, yes. To other not. So is it for the fine-grained actions as well, or rather for those big actions?
I think this is mostly for the big actions. Actually, I don't think we will get into UMA today, user-managed access. But user-managed access is some work that's been going on now for a couple of years. And it's the profile of OAuth just for doing that kind of thing. Fine-grained access control where the user wants to manage it himself or herself. So absolutely, I agree. Sort of, this is mostly for coarse-grained stuff, sort of, not very fine-grained, because then otherwise the scope would be, I don't know how many values you would need, actually. Like if you had a Flickr account and you have like 4,000 pictures, would you have sort of 4,000 scopes for managing that? Probably not. So you have to do it somewhat differently. And I think that's where UMA would probably solve the case, I think. So should we take a break? Stand up. Move around a bit.